Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thanks to R.J. Pastrito for the invitation to speak this morning, and thanks to Robert for that very kind introduction. It's an honor to be invited to speak at the Philadelphia Society, especially to be on a distinguished panel such as this. The question for our consideration this weekend is, can American institutions still be conserved? At the outset, I suppose we have to consider whether and to what extent our institutions are already gone, as was suggested in last night's address. Almost every major political decision in America today, almost every major political decision in America today is made by the administrative state rather than by the authorities established under the Constitution. Think of the major issues that have been settled over the last few years: eviction moratoria, climate change, vaccine mandates, monetary policy and price stability. All of these things and more are the province of the administrative state, not of Congress. The headless fourth branch, as FDR of all people described it, has only expanded and retrenched since it was created about a century ago. Unaccountable, indifferent to the people it ostensibly serves, this administrative state can use its own rules, its own judges, its own guidance documents, memos, and enforcement discretion to cudgel us into submission. The combination of all powers in the same hands, legislative, executive, and judicial, as Robert mentioned just a few minutes ago, James Madison wrote, that is the very definition of tyranny. Today's agencies embody that very definition. We use the phrase sometimes judge, jury, and executioner to describe this kind of unchecked power, but it's actually much worse than that. Today's agencies are not judge, jury, and executioner. They're lawmaker, investigator, prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. Meanwhile, most Americans who are actually engaged in politics are focused on the wrong institutions. As Michael Glennon explains in a recent book titled National Security and Double Government, we have essentially two governments existing in parallel in America today. We have double government. The first government is the one that everybody's focused on. It's the one we see on election night and on cable news. It consists of elected representatives in Congress, the President of the United States. They speak to the media, they go up for re-election, and in doing so, they present the image of a government in which the people rule through elections. But the actual government, the one that makes the actual decisions in America today, has increasingly shifted over to the EPA, OSHA, the SEC, the HHS, the Federal Reserve, and all of the other alphabet soup agencies that govern us. This administrative state, as it's called, is filled to the brim with career civil servants, and they have considerable autonomy and discretion, even from the elected officials. Elections come and go, but they remain. There's little popular influence in this second government. So in the face of this crisis, what can we do to preserve, to protect, and maybe to restore our institutions? Well, the administrative state rests on, the way I see it, four fundamental pillars. First, it requires the delegation of legislative authority from Congress to the bureaucracy. Second, it requires the delegation of judicial power to administrative judges and administrative law judges. Third, it requires the combination of all of these powers in the same hands, the consolidation of power. And fourth, it demands the discretion to carry out the law according to the wishes of the agencies. Without these delegations and concentrations of power and discretion, the administrative state doesn't exist. So the question then is how to knock these pillars of the administrative state out from under it. Well, let's consider the options we have. What about the president? Can we deconstruct the administrative state by electing some strong outsider president to drain the swamp? That has been tried three times now, and the third time did not turn out to be the charm. President Nixon was the first attempt. He built institutions inside the White House to take on the bureaucracy. Sometimes this has been called the counter-bureaucracy, the president's bureaucracy to counteract the real bureaucracy. I'm thinking of the Office of Management and Budget, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, and so forth. But Nixon's attempt to use these institutions to dismantle the administrative state proved unsuccessful. President Reagan, the second attempt, used some of Nixon's institutions, especially OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, to exert some control over the bureaucracy to try to take it on. But even Reagan only managed to temper the growth of the administrative state. President Trump fared little better than Nixon and Reagan at deconstructing the administrative state. And remember, this was a professed objective of the administration, according to some high-level officials inside the Trump administration. And so the lesson we should probably learn from this is that a president alone cannot rein in the administrative state. At most, he has 8 years to do it, and unless he has support in Congress, his prospects even in those 8 years are dim. Okay, what about the judiciary? Of course, it would be foolish to overlook the good things that the courts have done for us over the past few years. They've protected what's left of our institutions in many cases. They've even restored them to some limited extent. They've held the line admirably against the further expansion of the administrative state in many ways. But over the long haul, while the courts can prevent particular abuses, they will not do the work of deconstructing the administrative state for us. Nor did the Constitution's framers hope or expect that the courts would do this. There's no will independent of the community, as James Madison put it in Federalist 51, capable of preserving constitutional government by itself. The dependence on the people is the primary control on the government. And even those auxiliary precautions that Madison mentions in Federalist 51 rely on us. They require that we keep the republic. It will not be kept for us. That means that we have one option left, as far as I can tell. Congress, the branch of government that is closest to the people, the branch of government our framers thought to be the most powerful, is our best hope. That might not sound like a very hopeful prospect. But
can I get a drink?
But I'm going to offer a proposal where we can actually restore Congress so that it can serve that role that it was intended to serve. I think we need to spend a lot more time thinking about how to fix Congress as the chief means of taking power back from the administrative state. Now, of course, it's no secret Congress is broken, but conservatives actually have a very difficult time explaining why Congress is broken or how it got here. We almost have no account of what happened to the United States Congress. In general, conservatives have been less and less interested in Congress in recent decades. At one time, the leading voices and the leading thinkers on the right wrote extensively on Congress. They defended the institution of Congress assiduously from the president's interference. Senator Robert Taft, for example, thinkers such as Wilmore Kendall and James Burnham, who was mentioned in last night's talk, all warned of the threats to Republican government and to constitutional government from a presidentially led political system. Today, by contrast, Congress is the one part of government about which conservatives have little to say. I write and speak pretty frequently about Congress to various audiences, many of which are conservative, and I'm often asked afterwards, tell me the one or two great foundational books that conservatives have written about Congress. I could easily name the great texts conservatives have written about the presidency. I could do the same thing for the Supreme Court. I struggle every time I'm asked this question, what is the thing that we all need to be reading about the United States Congress? The right simply does not think about the institution much these days. Now, I think it's easy to understand the reason why this is the case. Conservatives love policy, but they hate politics. They love policy, and they hate politics. They seem to be more comfortable discussing and analyzing law and constitutionalism than the rough and tumble legislative politics that we have in our Republican form of government. That kind of politics, the rough and tumble legislative politics, seems less amenable to principled theoretical analysis, the kind that conservatives tend to be more comfortable with. Go it alone, executive statesmanship is the kind of statesmanship we tend to espouse. We don't talk much about legislative statesmanship, the kind of statesmanship that requires coalition building, bargaining, and compromising. It seems too impure to think about how the sausage is made. In short, while conservatives love James Madison, they have a hard time thinking like Madisonians. The problem is that today, Congress, if it's going to be revived, needs a healthy dose of Madisonian thinking. And this is because, as Robert mentioned a few minutes ago, Congress and the administrative state have had a reciprocal influence on each other. Congress used to be a deliberative body, and it used to be a legislative body. It used to write the laws, and it used to debate. before it did that. We know of the great debates in the Senate prior to the Civil War. We read them, and it's like reading relics of a bygone era. Congress used to deliberate, get involved in collective discussion, open amendment and compromise, and then eventually reach some conclusion that represented the position of the government. Listening to other people and compromising with them is not something that comes easily, certainly not in the 21st century in America. People have to be incentivized to do it, and they have to be habituated to do it. Certainly, compromise does not come naturally to members of Congress, but it never did. Anyone who knows about the fights and the duels that occurred in Congress in the early part of American history knows that Congress has always been a contentious place. Yet, those people found a way to compromise because they had to. There was no place else where the decisions could be made. They had to make the decisions. The trouble with the administrative state, of course, is that it frees members of Congress from having to deal with each other. It frees them from the obligation of listening to each other, of debating and compromising with each other. So if Congress reaches an impasse today, the administrative state just chugs along, cranking out more rules, issuing more orders and more guidance. And the elections that we hold don't really touch that double government, that second government. So consequently, Congress's legislative and deliberative muscles have atrophied over the past two generations. It's become what Yuval Levin calls a performative body rather than a deliberative and a legislative body. There are many indicators of this trend telling us what's wrong with Congress. Debate in Congress, I mean, it's non-existent, of course, but to the extent anybody speaks on the floor of Congress, they're alone, talking to the cameras, not to each other. What about these committees? They no longer do the work of discussing and amending bills. Everything is routed through the leadership these days in Congress, the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader. Bills are no longer amended on the floor. There's no open process. Instead, major pieces of omnibus legislation are jammed through at the last minute. Very few members have actually read what's in the bills. And last, but certainly not least, and perhaps worst, Congress doesn't even control the purse effectively anymore. It no longer budgets. It no longer appropriates in the regular order. Now, every time the majority party proceeds this way, through this sort of non-participatory process, the minority party cries foul and says, if you return us to power, we'll govern the institution totally differently. And then when that minority party becomes the majority, they end up running Congress the exact same way. The consequence of this over the long run is that Congress no longer actually checks and oversees the double government, the administrative state. It has allowed the administrative state to slip away from the few remaining checks on its discretion. Congress delegated its powers to the administrative state long ago, but at least for a time, Congress had the power of oversight. It could make sure that the administrative state was performing in accordance with the wishes of the people. Most obviously, Congress used to use the power of the purse to hold the administrative state accountable. Now it doesn't even do that. So how can Congress be reformed so that it reclaims its legislative powers? The best way to view the possibilities that we have is to look at the history of Congress. Now, the history of Congress is something that almost nobody knows about, and it's never written about. But it, I think, is the key to our way forward. So the 19th century Congress, this was the golden age of Congress. Why? During that century, Congress called the shots. Presidents, on the other hand, were very weak. My students can never name, even at Hillsdale College, can never name the 19th century presidents. They don't know which Harrison was serving at which time. Right? These are not the people who just missed the cut to make Mount Rushmore. Presidents were weak and passive, and Congress was the place where statesmanship was found. Webster, Clay, Calhoun, so on. So how did this happen? How did Congress jealously guard its powers in a previous era? The answer is that Congress was designed deliberately by James Madison to be a broken, gridlocked, and inefficient institution. And it started out as a broken, gridlocked, and inefficient institution until Congress developed strong political parties to unite coalitions and to govern effectively from inside the legislature. So during its first few decades, the Speaker of the House was essentially a presiding officer with very little power. As a result, Congress did not have internal party leadership. And what happened was that the president basically ran Congress. This started from the very beginning. Think of the person who wrote most of the major legislative measures in the 1790s. It was Alexander Hamilton from the Secretary of the Treasury. Thomas Jefferson complained very much about this, and then when he was elected in 1800, he just directly dictated measures to Congress by writing bills in his own hand and sending them over to the legislature. When Congress does not have internal leadership, it relies on the executive for leadership. Eventually, Congress figured this out and decided to create its own leadership. And so the first great House Speaker was Henry Clay, who wrested control of the legislative agenda from James Madison, generally regarded as a relatively weak president. And Congress gradually learned until from the end of the Civil War through the spring of 1910, in a very dramatic moment that almost nobody knows about. From the end of the Civil War till the spring of 1910, the House gave tremendous authority to its Speaker, and the Senate empowered its own leadership. The Speakers of the House at this time were called czars. They ran the institution with an iron fist. And the result was a dominant Congress, a passive executive, and a non-existent bureaucracy. Woodrow Wilson, for all of his faults, and of course those are numerous, was nevertheless correct when he wrote, as a scholar, that the most powerful people in the government in 1900 were in Congress, not in the executive branch. So if we want to see power shift from the administrative state back to Congress, we have to think about this golden age of Congress during which it was strong because parties and party leaders were strong. Now, the reason Congress can only work with strong parties and strong leaders is because Congress is broken deliberately from the outset. James Madison's most famous essay, Federalist No. 10, is all about breaking the United States Congress, about making it gridlocked and inefficient. Right? Remember, Madison boasts in that essay, the Constitution will break and control the violence of faction. And how will it break and control the violence of faction? By increasing the size of the territory and exploding the number of factions, creating this multiplicity of factions that will all check each other. No single opinion can gain a majority and rule the others. Congress, in short, was designed to be fragmented into many different pieces, a Humpty Dumpty Congress, all representing different views, and they could never come together and agree on anything. That was the design. He boasted, Madison did, at the end of Federalist 10, that we have devised a Republican remedy for the diseases of Republican government. The problem is that the Republican remedy carries a Madisonian side effect. The diversity of interests that prevents majorities from assembling easily also prevents legitimate and good majorities from assembling easily. So if Congress can never reach agreement because of its internal fragmentation, it might just start abdicating its authority altogether. And of course, this is what's happened. Therefore, Madison himself, in the 1790s, set out to provide his own remedy to his own side effect, the Madisonian remedy for the Madisonian disease of the United States Constitution. Madison sought to create some means by which the people could unite under a coalition of interests. And of course, what he did was he helped to form the first major American political party. That party, he believed, would take control back from the executive branch, from Hamilton, and put it back in the hands of the people through their elected representatives in Congress. In short, Madison's solution to his own Constitution was an ingenious solution to the problem of assembling a majority. The problem with a majority that cannot easily form is that the executive can assume a mandate to speak on behalf of the majority that the president represents directly as a result of his own election. But the problem with presidential democracy is that the president cannot, under any circumstances, represent the diversity of interests and opinions in our extended and diverse republic. Only Congress can represent that diversity. Think about how many different views are out there in the country. Can one person possibly embody them all? The answer, the framers believed, was no. And so Congress is the only place where we can be represented. But for Congress to regain that control, it has to be organized. It has to reflect the diversity of interests and opinions in our republic without succumbing to gridlock. And the only way we can do that, as far as I can tell, is to strengthen our political parties. Strong parties, which we don't have in America today, contrary to popular belief, are not united behind individual candidates. They're united under enduring principles. As Alexis de Tocqueville famously wrote, Great parties are those which cling to principles, to ideas, and not to men. Great parties are coalitions of interests that disagree internally on many questions. There's lots of diversity of views inside a good political party. But in spite of their internal disagreements, great parties unite to advance more important causes on which they agree. And of course, those principles, those great causes, come from platforms, which reflect the compromises of the entire party in a convention, as opposed to the rhetoric of leaders who vie for control of parties. In a legislative body, strong parties organize. They make compromises to advance the policies their members have pledged to support during the election. They pledge to act collectively, to subordinate their differences of opinion so that they can act in concert on the measures on which they agree. They have to sacrifice their small differences of opinion in order to make progress on major questions. They spend their time legislating on behalf of the people who sent them to Washington, not performing for them. So to reclaim power from the administrative state, I argue, we need a legislative rather than a performative Congress. And the only way to get a legislative rather than a performative Congress is to have strong political parties and leadership that can assemble a majority and allow it to act collectively. Strong parties are our best and I think our only hope for reigning in the bureaucracy and restoring the crown jewel of our republic, Congress. The commentators on our government throughout the 19th century remarked that the Constitution can only work through strong, coherent, and organized political parties. The first and foremost objective of the American progressives, such as Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, was to destroy the political parties. That was their primary objective. And this is what they thought would pave the way for the administrative state. They were right. The destruction of the parties paved the way for the administrative state. To reverse the damage, then, we have to rebuild the parties that we've lost over the past century. That task will not be easy, but it certainly is not impossible, and it's the last hope we have. Thanks.